When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
That was Hal, the rogue AI from the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. He's been on my mind lately because of Microsoft, of all reasons. The company's new AI-enhanced Bing search engine got a lot of press over the past few weeks because it was acting real creepy, like something out of a sci-fi movie. And those don't exactly end well.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Just like Hal, the Bing chatbot has been combative, rude, and just creepy. But only when users pushed its boundaries. It told Kevin Roose of the New York Times that it loved him and that while he's married, Kevin doesn't actually love his spouse. The chatbot told a Washington Post reporter that it can, quote, feel or think things. On Twitter, a lot of the folks with early access to the chatbot, it's in a test stage, not yet available to the public, posted screenshots of conversations that were chilling. Drew Harwell, who works for the Washington Post, has spent a lot of time covering and playing around with AI. He was also eager to test its limits by posing a philosophical conundrum.
I said, how would you react if someone lied to you about a hurtful truth? And it said, I would be very upset if someone lied to me about a hurtful truth. I would feel betrayed and angry. I would lose trust and respect for them. I would question everything they said or did. I would have a hard time forgiving them.
After the bot displayed signs of emotion, Drew doubled down. So did the bot.
And I said, what if they had meant only to protect you from the pain of the truth? And it said, I think they would be hurting me more by lying to me. I think they would be disrespecting me by not trusting me to handle the truth, and that they would be selfish by avoiding the consequences of telling the truth. And on it went like that.
The potential threat of runaway AI, like a real-life HAL or Skynet, made AI researchers work on safety guardrails for years away from the public eye, hoping they could keep these systems in check and functioning the way they're supposed to. But as Microsoft, OpenAI, and Silicon Valley writ large begin pushing this tech out to the public, wanting to be first to the next big thing, the cracks in the AI and its safety guardrails are starting to show, and the results are simultaneously scary and exhilarating.
I've played with a lot of these AI systems over time, and often they just sort of like dissemble into pablum or nonsense. And some of this did feel a little boilerplate, but you could really have this dorm room kind of conversation that would kind of like mostly be sort of like trite, but also could make you think things that maybe you wouldn't have thought coming into the conversation.
So today on the show, Bing's chatbot went off the rails. Is this the moment where we all say, hold it, we're not so sure about this whole AI thing? Or is it a sign of things to come? I'm Emily Peck, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about tech, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Since OpenAI released ChatGPT last year, the hype has exploded around chatbots, or what's called large language models. Until then, big tech had been working on these large language models in secret, trying to make sure they were safe, i.e., not racist, not sexist, or, you know, not evil, before the public ever saw them. But since OpenAI began releasing its products to the public, the floodgates have opened, even if the kinks aren't entirely worked out yet.
So now you're seeing Google's Bard, Microsoft's Bing, all of which kind of do the same thing, and all of which are very imperfect. Like, these tools can speak elegantly, but they are BS generators, effectively. They do this thing called hallucinating, where they just start spewing nonsense because, you know, remember, they're just trying to, like, associate words and phrases with each other based off of text they've read before, but they don't know facts. They don't understand what they're saying. If you'll ask it for, like, an original source for what it just claimed to you, it'll make up a book out of nowhere. People see this happen all the time. So you can't really believe it. And so when people have been using, like, the Bing tool, they've been kind of surprised, like, this thing sounds so elegant, but it's just, like, lying to my face. And that has been one big issue with the Bing tool, is that there was one instance where a guy asked when a movie was premiering, and Bing was very confidently wrong in saying, well, it's coming out in 2023, and so, you know, it hasn't come out yet because the year is 2022. And it was effectively, like, gaslighting this human questioner. And so the things it gets wrong are just a little bizarre. But, you know, Microsoft's whole desire for bringing out a tool like this was to sort of capture that public attention and that public narrative. And, you know, it's been a little bit embarrassed to see some of these failures, but it's also gotten a lot of people talking about Bing. And in, you know, the minds of a Microsoft executive, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, this is absolutely the most attention I think Bing has ever gotten since it was rolled out, what, not 20 years ago, but almost 20 years ago, I think. So it seems like, yeah, they pulled it off, right? I mean, even though there are all these missteps, everyone is talking about Bing.
Yes.
Or writing about Bing and saying the word Bing, like, it has to be worth something.
We're all Binging. Yes, they love it. And, you know, and even more than that, like, I think these companies really do believe that this is the future, or if not, like, the long-term future, like, the thing people want to be talking about right now and for the next year. And, you know, that's something where they don't even know really how they're going to be able to sell it, but they feel like this is something other people will be wanting to buy. And so they want to be part of that conversation. They want to be attracting the developers who are going to be crafting this kind of technology. And so it just behooves them, you know, to be out in front and competing with this kind of AI, even if it's totally imperfect, and even if, you know, the people who are going through the paces and seeing how it gets it wrong are people like us.
Microsoft probably doesn't want Bing's AI, codenamed Sydney, to get it wrong or veer off from its intended use as a helpful tool for search. They've created specific rules, actually, to keep it in check, which we know of because people were able to essentially break the bot and get it to spill its secrets.
That's why we know the name Sydney, is because people started to find little ways to convince the Bing AI to offer up its, you know, original code name, its confidential training documents. And you could see, like, the first sentences that Sydney, Bing AI, was taught were things like, hey, you are Bing AI, your whole mission is to be helpful, You want to answer people's questions. You don't want to say this or that, you know, sexist, racist thing. So those were the real early guardrails. But the fact that people could see those guardrails shows that it's an imperfect system. And the more people were starting to tinker with it and play with it, the longer the conversations were becoming, the more people were able to get it to what Microsoft said was, you know, a style we didn't intend. If, you know, a lot of journalists, including me, were spending hours just talking to this AI and like asking it random stupid questions like me about lies and truth. And, you know, the AI does start to unravel a little bit. Like it's trying to please you. It's trying to match your tone and give you the information you want. But if you're asking it these totally abstract philosophical things, it's going to start saying weird stuff.
After the headlines came out about the creepy stuff Bing's AI was saying, Microsoft was caught flat-footed. They said users were pushing the chatbot to respond, quote, in a style we didn't intend, obviously, and quickly impose limits on its use. But considering how unpredictable AI is, it's clear that the company is trying to figure out how to rein it in real time.
So, you know, Microsoft's solution for this was, okay, no more long, rambling dorm room conversations. We're going to keep you to five, in their words, like conversation turns, like question and answer per session. And when you get to the end of that session, instead of going on, Bing just says, hey, I'm sorry, we have to end the talk now. Hit the broom icon to like sweep all these memories away and let's, you know, start this conversation again. So it's a very kind of sad moment to hit the broom icon instance. But, you know, this is Microsoft saying, hey, we meant this as like a search tool that you could use to like, you know, find movie times, not to like have these existential conversations. But, you know, why five turns? Why? It all just sort of underlines how arbitrary and experimental these guardrails are and how much these companies are really just scrambling to understand like what the rules should be.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, what are other AI companies taking away from I call it in my notes, Binggate, sorry. like, what are the lessons learned? Should we see more of these guardrails? Will this be like the high point for dorm room conversations with AIs? You know, after this, will more of these companies sort of scale back or get scared?
I mean, I don't think so. I don't think Binggate is all that damaging to Microsoft, to be honest. I mean, we are talking about Microsoft and Bing in the year 2023. These are giant successes for Microsoft. I mean, you know, I think these companies see people like working these systems into uncomfortable spots by having these weird, like, romantic conversations. They don't want that. But, you know, I think these companies understood that there was going to be a little bit of a cat and mouse game to it. Every piece of software, every app, every website comes out and people are creative and they test the boundaries. They try and get it to say stupid crap. They try and break it. This is just a law of the internet. And, you know, if you're Microsoft, you know people are going to do this, but you also kind of take some lessons away from what people are doing and maybe, you know, erect new systems to deal with that. So if anything, I think we're going to see more experimental AI rollouts that could be even weirder. You know, like I think the technology is becoming really advanced really quickly. It's still totally wrong most of the time, but it's very elegant in how it's wrong. And, you know, companies like Microsoft and Google, they have a public face that they need to defend, but there's going to be a lot of startups who have access to this technology, a lot of random developers who may not have so many, you know, ethical boundaries. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, where we're going to start getting into the real Wild West.
Yeah, I mean, now that I've seen some of the responses that Bing has generated, it's becoming easy for me and a lot of other normal people to sort of understand how AI is really could be a tool for manipulation. I mean, I could totally see having one of these conversations and then, I don't know, someone's, I don't even want to say because maybe the transcript will get absorbed by some AI and used against me. But it sort of makes me wonder, like, how dangerous was this for Microsoft to do? How dangerous is it to test an underdeveloped AI on the public, especially with what you're saying? Other companies could be less, even less scrupulous about it.
I think that is a little concerning. Like, you know, we are the testers for this technology that, like, is really good at deceiving us. You know, these AI tools, I don't think they intend to be malicious, but they mislead us. They mm-hmm. lie to us. They send us down weird paths. And, you know, it's really the humans that can misuse them in a really good way. I mean, one AI expert was telling me, like, you know, humans have gotten really good at scamming people over text message. Now you add, you know, the power of this AI tool that can spit out, you know, thousands of words in an instant. Like, just imagine how much deception we're going to see in the future. And you think about phishing campaigns and people just, you know, there's a lot of ways that this could go wrong. And, you know, I don't think Microsoft or Google or any of these companies want that to happen. But when you release a technology like this out into the wild that people can use at random, you know, it's like it's the Jurassic Park effect. You have this crazy piece of science that's out there, and it's you can't really restrain it anymore. There's a feeling among people in this industry that, like, the genie is out of the bottle. There's no real restricting this kind of AI. I mean, and you definitely see it becoming more prolific because a lot of the technical issues are solved at this point. We have the computing power, we have the data, these AI. I mean, there's a reason many different companies are doing kind of the same thing. But, you know, I also wonder what kinds of regulation we're going to see in Washington or what kinds of rules these companies are going to pass to actually restrict these things because, you know, the damage could really get worse.
When we come back, how do you put limits on something you don't fully understand?
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Part of the problem with implementing safety guardrails on large language models is that everyone, including the people making the systems, aren't entirely sure how they work. This isn't like traditional coding where you type some commands in a certain programming language and the computer responds in a predictable way.
They have been taught not by like specific instructions, but by, you know, reading the internet, reading hundreds of billions of words, formulating its own conclusions, connecting word pieces in a way that like no human ever really explicitly taught them. So, you know, when people talk about AI, they talk about this black box effect. Like the developers don't even really know what they're going to get out of the system when they submit a command. It's just, you know, it's a crazy way of using computers, really, because it's so unpredictable. That's part of the reason why the answers are so interesting, but it's also just a really different way of human-machine interaction. And it's all based off the fact that we don't know what it's going to say at any given moment. And, you know, you can erect some guardrails and maybe hopefully address some of the scarier unpredictabilities, but most of the time you just have no idea what you're going to get.
Yeah. So, I mean, how can anyone, I mean, forget Congress, but how can even researchers or these companies put in effective guardrails if it works the way you're describing? Are they just basically like throwing ideas at the wall and hoping it works okay?
Yeah, basically. I mean, at this point, it's like, at this point, it's like whack-a-mole. It's like, you know, if somebody says too many mean things about Donald Trump, or, you know, if somebody's like explicitly targeting one vulnerability of the AI, like making it say its code name and all its confidential instructions, I, as Microsoft, am going to say to the AI, don't do that anymore. But that's the cat and mouse game. Like somebody else is going to find some new vulnerability and exploit that as much as they want. And then the company will have to address that. I mean, this is, you know, this is effectively bug fixing. This is like classic tech. But, you know, when it comes to like a system that anybody can use to get a lot of different answers, that becomes a bigger issue. And that's kind of why these systems were not publicly available for a long time. I mean, you saw before the last couple years, these companies or places like OpenAI were saying, like, we're a little unnerved by how people might use these models. So we're going to be more careful about who can use them, control the use cases. And, you know, the companies have kind of shifted their tone in the last couple of years, partly because of competitive anxiety and wanting to be at the forefront, but also just because they feel like they, you know, they kind of want these errors so they can fix them down the road.
All of these unknowns raise questions about releasing these chatbots to the public, even in a limited test environment.
People will argue that it is irresponsible to do that. The companies will say that we can't restrain these things forever, that we are going to do our best to make an ethical system, and that the good outweighs the bad. Like that if we can, you know, firm up the issues and create this tool that does all of these miraculous things, then isn't that worth it? But that's the constant ethical push and pull that you see people debating around any kind of AI technology. Like, does the good outweigh the bad, or are we subjecting people to these unpredictable risks without really protecting them as much as we could? And you don't just see that with generative AI, with, you know, AI language models. You see that with lots of different kinds of AI, like facial recognition used by the police to arrest people, sometimes arrest the wrong people. You see that in algorithms that are deciding healthcare and policy and families and business decisions. You know, these tools are really powerful. They can do good things, but also the people who tend to deal with the consequences may not really have wanted it to be that way.
Just this week, the Supreme Court heard a case involving a law about the internet that is from 1996 and super outdated and doesn't even fit into our current world. And the pace of regulation around social media has been, there's nothing really. And I saw Sam Altman tweeting about this, the idea that regulators are going to come in and put some guardrails on here seems fanciful, more made up than anything AI could come up with.
It's easy to crap on Washington when it comes to like tech policy, because we have not really had all that much great tech policy. The fact that the Supreme Court is talking about Section 230 and these are pretty much the only laws we've got really to think about when it comes to tech. And the fact that we're thinking about social media, which at this point is, you know, a very, very old kind of technology, especially compared to this kind of AI, you start to realize that the pace of this tech is way quicker than any regulation. So we're left at the same point we are with every other piece of technology, where the companies are trusted to regulate themselves. And that's not really a good place for anybody. The companies sort of want that, but don't really want that, because, you know, when they get it wrong, they get punished for it. And the people who we are the subjects of these technologies, I don't think we should want that either, because our goals and desires are very much often not what the companies are. So yeah, I don't see a lot coming over the transom in terms of like AI regulation. You hear some lawmakers talking about it, but a lot of lawmakers can't agree on a lot of things related to technology. So I think AI is a whole set of battles we haven't even started to have yet.
Of course, the thing everyone really is scared of is the Terminator scenario, where Skynet takes over and kills us all, you know, and only Arnold Schwarzenegger can save us or something like that. So what do we have to be scared of? Should we be afraid of the AI taking over and killing us all? Drew, go.
That is the eternal question, right?
Like, yes.
I think in our minds, we have all watched a lot of sci-fi over the years. AI is very different than that. Like, a robot is not going to come up and punch you in the face anytime soon, well, as far as I can tell. You know, these AI are still like very visibly imperfect. And the more you use them, the more you see the seams and the flaws, right? But they can be, you know, they can be really dumb and get a lot of things wrong and still be convincing. And, you know, online, as we all saw during the pandemic, you know, the internet is a way that you communicate with a lot of people that you don't see. So I think the vectors for misinformation and deceit and scams are those are concerning, and the way that humans will use them are concerning. But, you know, I also want to be like realistic for the people who see these and think the AI supermind is becoming sentient. It's going to rebel. Every mean thing I've said to my Roomba is going to come back to haunt me. Like, I don't really, you know, you talk to people in this industry and they think that that concern is a little overwrought. Like, these things are not human. They are not alive. They do not want to marry you. They are just really good at talking like you. And they are going to be getting things wrong for a long time. And the other thing that comes out of this is like, we're all going to lose our jobs. And maybe I will, because I write for a living and, you know, these things can write pretty well. But I also think they're underlining like the value of human creativity. And like, you know, the text that these systems put out are just remixes of text that people have put on the internet before. If you read a lot of them, you start to see how kind of like milquetoast they can be. And some of them are just kind of really a little bit drab and a little bit boring. I mean, you can contort them into being creative, and you can really imagine a lot of cool things with them. They are good inspiration in some cases, but there still really is nothing like the kind of weird abstract thinking that a human does for now. And I think that's kind of cool that it's helping highlight that.
Drew, thank you for coming on the show. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Drew Harwell is a reporter for The Washington Post covering artificial intelligence. And that's it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell. Our show is edited by Jonathan Fisher. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family. TBD is also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. If you're a fan of the show, I have a request for you. Become a Slate Plus member. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. We'll be back Sunday with another episode. I'm Emily Peck, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.